Commonwealthy Chorale. And the Commonwealth, Miss Kiernan, are you prepared? Ready?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, I guess good afternoon, rather, Your Honors. May it please the Court, this is Elizabeth Kiernan, and I represent the Commonwealth on appeal. I'd like to request about 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, counsel.
Thank you. Officer Williams' limited search of the defendant's console in this case did not violate the Fourth Amendment. Specifically, his actions were justified pursuant to the car frisk exception in Michigan versus Long, because in this case it was reasonable for him to believe the defendant had secreted a weapon in his vehicle, and he would have immediate access to that weapon once he was allowed to re-enter his vehicle. The Long analysis takes into account the perspective of a reasonable officer trained for the purposes of law enforcement and considers the totality of the circumstances facing that officer. Here, those circumstances fall mainly into three categories. First, drug activity. Second, furtive movements. And third, nervous behavior. Although none of these circumstances alone are sufficient, all three are present in this case. And this court has found that combination of circumstances to give rise to reasonable suspicion in the past, specifically in cases such as Glover, Pearson, and unreported cases, Johnson and Smith. So in particular, we have in this case indicia of drug activity, and this is more than just a high-crime neighborhood, such as was present in McKean, and more than a generalized policy of frisking every person that someone comes in contact with. Here, Officer Williams, who is a 12-year veteran of the police force, and the narcotics and street interdiction supervisor testified that he saw what he believed to be the defendant and an occupant of this house ferrying an object back and forth between the truck and the house. Based on these movements, he testified that he believed something was being transported to and from. The trial court further found in this case that it was likely that this officer had a substantial suspicion of drug activity. So we have in this case involvement of the defendant or suspected involvement with drug activity, which the court knows also gives rise to an inference of dangerous, and there is a strong connection between drugs and guns. The second,
Judge Fred, let me ask you about that inference. We're here on a Commonwealth appeal, so we take the facts in a light most favorable to the defendant. Didn't the trial court reject that inference in its finding?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The trial court found that the police officer's actions in this case were inconsistent with his stated belief that the person was dangerous, specifically because he being the officer, did not frisk the defendant when he got out of the car. That factual finding does nothing to touch whether or not the defendant may have had a weapon in his car in the first place, or why the officer didn't.
But if the officer can infer that guns might be present because they're drugs, that's all well and good. But it seems as if the trial court rejected that and said, "Well, I don't think that inference is something we could draw here based on his ruling."
I believe the trial court made a finding that the police officer subjectively didn't believe that the defendant was armed and dangerous. However, the correct mechanism for looking at these cases is what an objectively reasonable officer in those circumstances could have believed. And to the extent that this officer did see the defendant at this particular house that's involved with narcotics trafficking, an objective officer in his position could believe that the defendant was armed and dangerous, whether this particular police officer did or didn't. So the extent the trial court made a factual finding about what this officer in this circumstance believed, I don't believe the court is bound by that when looking at what an objectively reasonable officer in these circumstances could have believed.
Okay.
Furthermore, the furtive movements at issue in this case occurred while the defendant was driving, while he was being followed by the police officer. The defendant suggests that his movements were not furtive because he didn't know he was being followed by a police officer. And again, even viewing the record in the light most favorable to the defendant, there's plenty of evidence in the record to suggest that the defendant was aware he was being followed. Specifically, there was testimony in this record regarding the obvious nature of the police car. That testimony can be found at appendix page 18 and 35. The police officer testified that this was a obvious, it was obviously an undercover car. It had the lights, it had the antennas.
Counsel, in terms
yes.
of factual findings by the trial court, was there any factual finding relating to whether he knew that he was being followed by a police officer?
No, there was not, Your Honor. The trial court's ruling did not make a specific specific finding in that regard.
Is there any evidence that he knew he was being followed by a police officer? Anything that would support that conclusion?
Sure, Your Honor. In addition to the testimony about the nature of the car and the fact that the defendant looked over his shoulder at the officer,
I thought the description of the car the officer gave was that it didn't have any markings on it at all. It was an undercover car with no markings.
It was an unmarked car, Your Honor. That's correct. Although it did have the spotlight, the antenna, and the officer testified most people would understand or would recognize that this was an unmarked police car. It was a Chevy, I believe it was a Chevy Impala, just like the majority of cars in the fleet. Moreover, Your Honor, the defendant's actions demonstrate that he was aware this was a police car. As soon as the officer turned his lights on, the defendant pulled over immediately. When the officer approached, he already had his license and registration in his hand, and he said, "I know why you pulled me over." These actions are inconsistent with a stated belief that he was not, or that with his stated unawareness, that he didn't know he was being followed by a police officer. Furthermore, given the defendant's actions,
Counsel, didn't the trial court reject that, though, implicitly, if not explicitly?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The trial court's factual findings, again, focused on why the police officer may or may not have elected to frisk the defendant following that stop. However, the trial court didn't make any findings about what was going on prior to the stop, in particular, whether the defendant knew that that he was being followed by a police car. It seemed as if the trial court focused mostly on McCain and also on the officer's actions in not frisking the defendant and also approaching the car without backup. However, again, assessing the officer's actions in that way is inconsistent with the Fourth Amendment review, that we do review the officer's actions in an objective manner rather than a subjective manner.
Thank you, counsel.
Sure. If we consider these furtive movements, and the furtive movements in this case are greater than the furtive movements, for example, in the cases cited by the defendant on his brief, the defendant cites, in particular, Astle versus Commonwealth. In that case, a police officer approached a car that was parked on the entrance ramp, and as he was approaching that car, the defendant made a movement there, and likewise in McCoy, which is a federal case out of the First Circuit, we have a single, pushing motion or putting something under the seat. In this case, we have the defendant driving and making multiple movements towards the console, towards the floorboard, gestures so great that his head and shoulders disappear from view. He also looked over his shoulder at the police officer after making each of these gestures. These are significant furtive movements, and again, it was reasonable for the officer to believe that he knew that the defendant knew a police car was behind him, particularly given his reaction to the police car when he did get pulled over, immediately pulling over, and again immediately saying, "I know why you pulled me over, and here's my license and registration."
Counsel, what is the significance of the officer having the defendant get out of the vehicle and therefore being away from any kind of potential concern and then not patting him down?
Your Honor, it's not significant. The United States Supreme Court in the Michigan case iterated that someone who is outside the car and in police control or in partially in police control is no less dangerous because of that partial state of control or arrest. and it's possible for them to break free and access weapons that may be in the car. So
but
the fact
what,
that the
what extent did Gant limit the holding in Long?
Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, I believe that Michigan versus Long is still in force and effect. In fact, there's a footnote in Gant noting that other exceptions involving automobiles are still in play. And although there may not be a blanket rule, the facts of this case do give rise to a reasonable suspicion under Terry, which is still a valid reason to enter a car for the limited purpose of ensuring that there's not a weapon there that the defendant could gain immediate access to.
What relevance you talk about that there was furtive movement, of course, in the automobile, but was there not also furtive movement by the appellant when he was pulled over and he's out of the vehicle and he's standing there and he's putting his hand in and out of his pocket and yet they still don't search him for any weapon?
Because your officer, because your honor, reasonable suspicion takes into account the defendant's actions, not the police officer's actions. What the police officer did or didn't do does not contribute to the finding of reasonable, articulable suspicion. And in this case, whether the police officer subjectively decided to frisk him or not frisk him is not relevant to whether he had reasonable suspicion to believe there was a weapon in the car.
Didn't he have reasonable suspicion with him going in and out of his pocket to think that he might be armed and dangerous standing there, and yet he failed to frisk him, and then goes to the car?
Perhaps, Your Honor, but whether or not he had reasonable suspicion to believe that he had a weapon both in his car and on his person, the fact that he limited his intrusion to the place in the vehicle where the defendant admitted that he had been reaching and where he saw him reaching speaks to the limited nature of this intrusion. Moreover, if the police officer believed the defendant had been hiding something in his car, it's reasonable for him to think it's no longer on the defendant's person. What he saw were what he believed to be furtive gestures for someone concealing something, concealing a weapon in the car. This movement that he saw the defendant making in the car were not consistent with him concealing an item on his person. So I would argue it would be reasonable for him not to frisk the defendant once he was outside the vehicle, being more concerned with what was inside the car. And in this case, he was only being pulled over for a taillight, and so he would have been gaining access to that car again at the conclusion of this traffic stop.
Does the record indicate where the defendant was when the search occurred? Was he in custody of the backup officer?
Your Honor, I believe that he was told to stand at the back of his vehicle with the backup officer.
So is that within the reaching distance that the Supreme Court talks about in Long? Or is it more similar to a person who is in custody as described in Gant?
No, Your Honor, this is a situation that is more similar to Long because although the defendant was outside his vehicle, the weapon was inside in a place where he would have immediate access to it if he were allowed to reenter that vehicle. And that's
but he's
the situation
not just outside the vehicle. He's outside the vehicle in the custody of, or certainly under the observation of, the backup officer, who we assume is equally as armed as the searching officer.
Yes, Your Honor, and that specific argument was addressed in Michigan versus Long, and I believe also addressed by this court in Glover versus Commonwealth, where it said that whether the police officer had control of the defendant or not, based on the dangerous nature of roadside encounters, it was possible for him to break free of control of the officers and re-enter the car. And that is true whether, and these cases all arise out of situations where the person is not in the vehicle. They have been removed from the vehicle before a search takes place. A similar situation occurred. Let's see.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I hate to interrupt you, but you're well into your rebuttal time, and the court took you there, so we'll give you a little bit of time at the end, but you are into your rebuttal.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. I was looking at my timer here. About 30 seconds left, I believe. Unless the court has any questions, I'll make a very brief rebuttal with the court's permission after the appellee argues.
Thank you, counsel. Okay. Mr. Ballard, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. We're ready to hear from you, sir, when you're ready.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Matt Ballard for the appellee. I disagree, obviously, that the police officer had a reasonable fear that Mr. Crowell was armed and dangerous. And I think it most appropriate to start with the facts, and I don't want to reiterate too much of what the Commonwealth has said, but this is a stop that occurred in the late afternoon that actually stopped in a business parking lot. The Commonwealth
described... Mr. Ballard, this is just... Yes, you do not cite Arizona v. Gant in your brief. Are you conceding that that case has nothing to do with the case before us?
Well, I wouldn't say it has nothing to do with it, Judge. I mean, it's certainly part of the progeny. I mean, I did, of cases, I tried to zero in on...
Well, can you tell us why you think it applies to the facts of this case?
Well, just in terms of Michigan v. Long and Gant, Judge, I think the idea is clear that, I have to concede the Commonwealth point that a protective sweep in some situations is permissible.
All right, thank you.
Yes, sir. I disagree that this is a case that involved, as the Commonwealth has described it, ferrying something back and forth, or that the officer Williams in this case even was able to articulate that there was anything like that going on, that he didn't describe any hand-to-hand transactions, and there was nothing he described as being secret or clandestine about the motions, merely a person moving back and forth from a vehicle to a home, much like Evan McCain. Judge, and as Your Honors have touched on, this is a case where I don't think it's fair to describe or to place much importance on what the officer described as furtive movements after the officer was behind Mr. Crowell's vehicle in an unmarked car that had tinted windows when the officer was not wearing a uniform. I think it's important for two reasons. I don't think it's even in a situation where you have a marked car, I don't know that it's appropriate to or reasonable for an officer to think that any motions the driver of another vehicle would be making in the presence of a car that doesn't have its emergency equipment activated would rise to the level of furtive movements that has anything to do with the officer's presence. And again, in this case, this is an unmarked car with no markings on the side, tinted windows, and an officer not in uniform. And it was before the emergency equipment had been activated. Also important, I believe, is that in the Aswell case, the movements inside the car weren't inherently culpable movements or movements that you could necessarily attach to anything being hidden. There was some reaching towards the floorboard, which could have quite a number of innocent explanations, like the explanation given by the defendant that he was throwing something away. The Commonwealth is...
Interrupt and ask a quick question. What were the trial judge's factual findings, if any, regarding whether the defendant did or didn't know that there was a police officer behind him, and the officer's explanation about the quick pulling over?
Judge, the only light I think that's been shed, well, the best signal I think the trial court sent as to, and I'm looking in the appendix right now for the page number, but the trial judge granted an objection to the defense counsel's objection to the officer making the conclusion that the defendant knew he was being followed by a police officer, and the nature of the objection was that a conclusion and it called for speculation. I don't know. Other than that, the court did not make an explicit factual finding about whether or not Mr. Carell knew he was being followed.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. And on that same topic, I think that if anything, turning around in the direction of a police officer would be inconsistent with Mr. Carell believing a police officer behind him, and more consistent with him being curious as to who was behind him. Certainly someone who was trying not to draw attention from law enforcement wouldn't turn around repeatedly to look exactly in that direction. Once the equipment is activated, and I think that's when the important part of the analysis begins, Carell is compliant. He follows all the instructions that are given to him. He exits the vehicle to look at the third brake light that the officer asks him, when the officer asks him, even after he acknowledges that he had a defective third brake light, which is a little curious, like the idea that pulling over too soon after emergency equipment had been activated, or that looking at the officer as he approaches in the rearview mirror, or being too quick to hand over a license and registration would be signs to a reasonable police officer.
Did the officer describe his demeanor as unusually nervous?
He described him as nervous and that he had heavy breathing, Judge.
He made note of the fact that it must have been unusual for him to note that. I mean, everybody's a little bit nervous when they get pulled over, but he seemed, from the officer's description, to be a little extremely nervous.
Well, I'm not playing games with the court, obviously. I don't know that he used the language unusual or certainly extremely, but I would think that the officer was certainly trying to send the message to the court that he was unusually nervous, or nervous in a way that the officer felt was noteworthy, although I'd be quick to point out, Your Honor, that nervousness alone is not enough. I think the case law is clear in that respect.
But if you've got the fact that he appeared to be nervous, there was some type of movement in the car the officer did take note of that could be conceived as trying to hide something. The fact that he had been coming from or had been meeting with someone coming from a house where narcotics had in the past, at least on two separate occasions, been found. Putting all of those together, why isn't it appropriate for the officer to just do a pat down to make sure the car, if you will, to make sure that there wasn't a weapon there that could cause injury?
Well, Judge, I think it's a lot like McCain. I think that
McCain is unpublished, isn't it?
Well, no, Judge, the Supreme Court took up McCain as well, and that's 650.
Okay.
Excuse me. 275. I'm sorry.
You're right.
And in that case, Judge, the court, the Supreme Court of Virginia made clear that, you know, in that case, the defendant was in a vehicle that had been at a drug house, and there was some movement back and forth from the vehicle, and the defendant was described as being nervous and edgy, and I think the Court of Appeals, perhaps not the Supreme Court, took notice of the fact that, or referenced the fact that the officer testified that McCain looked like he was about to run. So, and that was the case where ultimately the Supreme Court of Virginia found that the search was not reasonable. Terry type frisk was not reasonable. And it's worth pointing out, I think, that the Commonwealth mistakenly believing that was a matter that was merely an unpublished case from the Court of Appeals. I don't mean merely casting an aspersion on the Court of Appeals, but certainly thinking that's where the case had ended, relied on the facts as being on point and identical to the situation here, and was caught by surprise at the suppression motion that the matter had been taken up by the Supreme Court and had ultimately gone the other way, so to speak. Honor's question. I'm sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. I was thinking about the trial court's comment about the unpublished opinion.
And, Judge, I think it's worth looking at the fact that once the officer stops the truck, Mr. Correll is removed from the truck, and he is not frisked. He, even though the case law is clear that that Officer Williams could have taken some measures, he could have secured him outside of the vehicle, and he had, under MEMS, he could have taken complete, you know, control of Mr. Correll during the course of the stop. They allowed him to move around freely, and of course, even Officer Williams would concede that once the emergency equipment on his vehicle was activated, there were no movements in the car that caused him any concern, and there was nothing inside the car when he was at the window that caused him any concern. Things that were listed out by the McCain court, any notice of any reference, any signs of drugs or odor of drugs, paraphernalia, physical mental impairment, which would corroborate the idea that he was in fact leaving a house in an effort to get drugs. And so there's nothing that caused any concern to corroborate the idea that there was anything about what was happening at that home. And once outside of the vehicle, again, Judge, he was not secured in any way. And as has been pointed out, he was not frisked. He was not secured. And the officer left him in the area of the back of the truck and went straight to the center console and searched the center console. So there were there was some nervous behavior, perhaps tapping of his jacket and putting his hand in his pocket after being told not to in January. I would describe that as nervous behavior, not uncooperative behavior, and not evasive behavior. There's also been, the Commonwealth has made reference to the correct standard having been applied, and I'm not certain that is, there were no questions about that, but I think that looking at the trial judge's decision, it's clear that he did not consider a subjective standard, that he relied on McCain, which is not a case that goes into subjective versus objective, and the trial judge expressly declined to comment on what the officer's motivation might have been. That concludes the thrust of what I expected to argue. Are there any questions?
Any questions?
No, I have none. Thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we'll give the Commonwealth a couple of minutes to do a rebuttal since we took so much of your time, Ms. Karen.
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm still on mute. Thank you. Trying not to use speakerphone, I understand that. It's difficult. Just briefly, Your Honor, to touch on a point that Judge Petty raised earlier, I understand that defendant is not pushing the applicability of Gantt, and certainly these cases are pre-Gantt, but in both Long and Glover, the defendant was not frisked until after the police officers found the weapon in his car. Likewise, it's not significant in this case that the defendant was not frisked while he was standing outside of the car. The police officer doesn't have to be absolutely certain that there is a weapon in that car. It's the reasonable suspicion standard, and that's the level that we're dealing with here. We do have all three factors present, all three of them, which distinguishes this case from McCain, from Aspel, and from Moore, which was also cited by the defendant, in which one factor alone was not significant, nervousness alone not significant, high crime area alone not significant, and also nervous or furtive movements alone not significant. But in this case, we do have all three. And the trial court did not make express factual findings with regard to that. The trial court's ruling is on pages 56 and 57 of the joint appendix, and I may have there may be some ellipses in it, but it was also cited in full in the Commonwealth brief. There aren't factual findings to preclude the inferences that we're asking the court to draw in this case.
What factor is present in this case that you do not think was present in McCain? How is this distinguishable?
Yes, Your Honor. First, McCain involved in that case opens with a statement that what the court is dealing with in that situation is the circumstances under which a law enforcement officer may conduct a pat-down search of a passenger in a vehicle for weapons. And what we have here is the driver of the vehicle.
Well, that doesn't make any difference, does it?
That was probably a bad place to start, Your Honor. I apologize for that. We can move to perhaps most significantly what we don't have in McCain that we have here are furtive movements, multiple furtive movements while the defendant is being followed by a police officer. We have those reaching movements. We also have a car. In McCain, the car was going to be towed. Both the people were leaving the car, and it was being taken away. In this case, the defendant was going to regain access to that car as soon as his citation for his brake light was going to be out. So we do have a situation where the defendant would be going back to the car and could gain immediate control of weapons. We also have nervousness in this case, nervousness when he's approached by the police officer. He was visibly nervous. I believe they said his hands were shaking, and that nervous behavior did continue outside. Although there was slight nervous behavior in McCain, nothing as significant as we have in this case. And perhaps most significantly, the McCain court made clear on multiple occasions that what they were dealing with was essentially a generalized policy of frisking every individual they came into contact with simply because of the nature of the area, the dangerous area. One of the officers testified that he had a personal policy of frisking every person he came into contact with. That kind of policy doesn't allow for the individualized type of suspicion that's required by Terry and by extension required by Long. What we have in this case, though, is an individualized suspicion. He was following this person in this car. The driver was the one making the furtive movements. The driver was the one to go to and from the house, and the driver was the one exhibiting nervous behavior. And we have an individualized suspicion here. Sure, and I believe that I've exceeded Your Honor's rebuttal allotment, and I'll ask the court to reverse and remand for further proceedings in this case.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Any other question from the judges?
No.
Okay.
No.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, both counsel, thank you for appearing by teleconference today, and the court will now adjourn and go into conference.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.